Gallagher wouldn't get a photograph of me. And I was like, oh, raging. And he goes, you're just too tall. The opening line was, I'm not crazy and neither are half the people in here. And they really weren't. Like when you're on stage, you have no time to think. Yeah. Give me time to think and I'll fall apart.
Yeah. Know? Welcome to Home with Drink with Charlene and Ellie. Our podcast is like a group chat between your best friends, the girls brought you on a night out where you spill all the gossip and relationship dilemmas and life. If you're a tour listener, welcome back. And if you're new here,
welcome.
Still don't feel real that people listen to us every week.
I know, yeah.
Sometimes I think about it, I'm like, oh.
I wonder what, scary. What goes through people's heads when they listen.
No, probably nothing. Yeah. Monkeys.
Yeah.
Ding, 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 ding. Monkey with the symbol.
Oh.
Home Drink is out for you every Wednesday at 12 p.m. We also have bonus episodes every Monday at 12 p.m. You can listen to more of us now on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can also watch us now on YouTube. So our weekly podcast episodes are uploaded to YouTube every Thursday at 12. This week, we have a very special guest. So Niall Breslin joins us to tell us all about his new podcast series, The Badman's Hotel, and to talk about his life and his changing careers and just
a bit of everything.
A bit of everything. My mom is absolutely delighted we got
my mother is showing.
Like, she texts me like on, we originally went to do Tuesday. She's like, good luck today with Brezzy. I was like, oh, it's actually Thursday instead. She was like, well, good luck then Thursday.
My mother's going to be the first person to listen.
Literally the first listener.
Mommy, ever. Love Brezzy.
Literally. Love you. Enjoy. So this week, like we said, we're joined by Niall Breslin. Welcome to Home.
How are you?
Hi.
What's going on?
We need to ask you first. Do you call you Brezzy or Niall?
Honest to
what
God.
Do you like?
The whole Brezzy thing came and the voice put my name in the back of a chair and they wouldn't change it. So like, I have other nicknames that I'd rather you not call me. But
right.
Either of those are fine.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Niall or Brezzy, I'm pretty
So did they make up my name Brezzy?
No, I was called Brezzy, but like it didn't want my name in the back of a chair. An RTE, but they couldn't fit Niall Breslin, so
okay,
so Brezzy, and that was it. And I was like,
stuck.
RTE were like, we're not changing your chair. And like, grand,
I used perfect. To love the voice, yeah. I was hooked, loved it.
I stressed about it.
Does that feel like years ago now, or
well, it was 5 years of TV, and I had never done TV before, so I was completely all over the shop for the first year. Like, and then like the first part of it was pre-recorded, but you do 5 shows in a day. And you'd be there for 14 hours. Jeez. And by the end of it, you still have to say the same thing. But like the families would be sitting in front of you, kind of giving you a stink eye, kind of going,
oh, throw me 20 quid.
Oh, no.
like the lads singing 5 keys out of tune, and they'd be like, hit the button.
Yeah. I can't really hit the button here.
But yeah, I mean, I definitely was a serious experience, because like, I'd never done television. But would I do entertainment television again? Not a hope.
Would you not? No. Is it just the long hours that you think now?
It's a different thing.
Yeah.
And it's like, I mean, really enjoyable, unbelievable crew, but I found it just not what I kind of made a very definitive decision when it was over. I had an agent in the UK and he was like, oh, I'm going to put you forward for, oh, no, I'm good.
No.
I'm done. And that was the end of my TV.
Wow. Well, yeah. Is it very emotionally draining? Because you're like, you have all these people who really want it and like, I'd be pressing it for everyone.
But you see, that's your problem. And then, you know, the voice wasn't like the expert. You weren't throwing people under buses.
Yeah.
Like,
no.
They weren't great. You couldn't go, you're not good. You'd have to find a reason. There's only so many ways you can tell people they can't sing.
They can't, yeah.
And the other thing about it is, like, I never, ever sold myself as a brilliant singer. I wasn't that at all. Like, and that's not why I was there. I know what I like with voices. And I like voices that aren't very good.
Okay.
I don't like perfect voices.
Right.
I don't like really brilliant technical, like the Mariah Careys, who are obviously some of the greatest vocalists of all time.
Mm-hmm.
Their voices don't do a lot
for
me.
For you,
I listen to kind of singers who you probably think they're not great singers, but I love them.
Yeah.
So that was my thing. So RT were like, you got to pick a few Mariah Careys. I was like, right.
You're like, oh,
yeah. I want the off key.
Yeah.
You've had quite a varied career in what you've done. So you started in rugby. So how many years did you play rugby for?
Well, I actually was a Gaelic player. I started as a Gaelic footballer. I loved Gaelic. Absolutely loved it. I played down at Westmeath and we had brilliant underage teams. And then I was huge. I was 6'6" when I was 16 and they were like, you're going to play rugby?
Yeah. Were you 6'6" when you were 16?
Yeah.
Wow.
I was a big young lad and I kind of just started playing and Mullingar is a brilliant club there, Mullingar Rugby Club. And I kind of just, like everybody, I just fell into it. But when I became a professional rugby player and I was 19, 20, and I had to give up Gaelic football and it broke my heart.
Did it?
Yeah, I love.
Were you given like the choice between the two?
No, you can't do both. Like you just couldn't. It was just so much, so much work. And I mean, I don't miss rugby at all. I miss Gaelic football. Gaelic football is so simple.
I
played professional rugby for 3 years and I still didn't know the rules.
Really?
Like, I genuinely didn't know what I was doing half the time.
Really?
Yeah, so, but Gaelic there's a lovely simplicity to Gaelic football.
Okay.
Yeah.
And curling is a lot more skillful, but there's still a simplicity to it.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's why I loved the sport and I loved my teammates and I loved the community thing. And that's what I miss from sport more than anything, not rugby.
Would you ever go back? Can you do Gaelic? No, Gaelic.
By even saying it out loud, I'll tear my hamstring. my body is...
It's not able.
No. I cannot do any of it. Like, and the thing about it is, like, I always have these little... Our lads, like when you hit your 40s, you start doing things like Christmas. They'll have a Christmas. They go, lads, we'll have like a charity football game or a charity five-a-side thing. Every one of them, Stephen's day, are just sitting in the pub with a torn hamstring.
Yeah. Just so in bits in the pub.
It's not worth it.
Yeah.
It's not worth it. You know when the body's giving up on you. Stop.
And when did you decide to stop the rugby?
I got probably 2.5 years into it. Okay. 3 years. Wow. And then decided that the obvious movement then into music.
Yeah.
I retired from rugby and started a band. I had nothing else to do. Like, and the band quite quickly did well. We signed to, you know, Universal Records and it just took off very quickly. And that was it. Wow. Rugby was in the rear view mirror.
So going from rugby to music, what is that like as a transition in your everyday of what you're doing? Like, you're going from being so active to not.
It was great.
Yeah.
It was great. Yeah.
Your body's feeling great.
Yeah. It was funny because my rugby agent was a guy called James Adams, who's a South African guy. And he said to me, when I said I was retiring, he was like, great. And he'd worked so hard for me. And then he said, send me your demo. So I just thought he was trying to be nice about it. So I sent him our demo and it was grand, like a 4-track thing we did. And he shared an office with the Oasis manager, Marcus Russell. We were huge Oasis fans.
Wow.
And 3 days later, in Eamon Doran's in Temple Bar, the Oasis manager was in the front row.
Stop.
Yeah. So that was the kind of stuff. So it was mad. It was just it just took off. And I was kind of playing gigs when I was still playing rugby. And I remember doing a gig in one car. We had played Munster the night before and I'd broken my nose. So my nose was 2 black eyes, cut here and a broken nose. And I had to go up and sing. And there was about 12 people there and they were all terrified of me. So they clapped. But but that's when I said, I better decide, do I want to play music or do I want to play rugby?
Yeah.
And then you definitely can't play Gaelic and rugby. You definitely can't play music.
Yeah, you can't
rugby.
Do it all. No. Like, was music always a thing in your life or?
Yeah, my mum's a music teacher.
Okay.
So my mum was classical violin, piano player. So she used to give lessons in our gaff. And wow. I don't know if you've ever heard anyone getting violin lessons. It's pretty painful.
Oh, you did them, did you?
Oh. My poor family.
Oh my God.
For 4 years. I don't know if it was 10, but I'd say for 4, it was like a cat scratching.
3 hours a day in our house.
No.
I was just studying for my Leaving Cert. And
it was probably me. I was probably
one young fella and going, you're useless. Stop playing. Yeah, he just didn't want to be there. Like,
it's horrible. Yeah. I used to cry walking to violin lessons.
Oh, it's I was like that with piano lessons because my piano teacher used to hit me in the fingers. when I used to play. And so I used to want to do that. But ultimately, I'm delighted I did because it's my favorite instrument. But my mum, music is, I always say sport is what I did. Music is what I am.
Okay.
I love music. I love all aspects. I love most music. I love playing it. I love writing it. I love listening to it. It's just such a privilege. I'm so lucky I have it.
And do you think that like sport and music makes you re-disciplined than in life in other areas?
Yeah.
I feel like when I done violin, it taught me how to like, keep doing something even when you're kind of shit.
Even when you hate it.
Discipline
is important. Like, the thing about it is, no matter what you want to excel in or whatever craft you want to do, you do need a discipline. Like, there's days you don't want to be doing it and there's days that you have no interest in it.
Yeah.
But I think disciplines are showing up. Like, that's all it was. But I think when you're a professional athlete, you're very structured.
Yeah.
Everything is completely structured. When you're a musician, you're completely unstructured. There's no structure.
True, you're on your own.
You have to figure out how to bring that into your own thing. But even when you're touring, like touring is just, I look back, we used to call them toilet tours. We'd tour the UK, like you play the worst venues. And this is the way you earned your stripes.
Right.
You go into the worst venues in like Hull on a Sunday night. When I remember playing Hull on Sunday night, there was one person there, the barman, and even he left. That's how you build your your reputation.
Your ego.
But you got
to
do it. You know, a lot of bands come up to me now and go, oh, you know, or like they've kind of made their name on TikTok, but they've never got on a live stage.
Mm.
You have to get into the live craft. That's where you learn.
Do you think there is such a big difference now? Because like you just said there, I feel like a lot of up and coming things nowadays are like that on TikTok and Instagram and people being found online. But do you think there is a big difference of interacting with a crowd and just sitting in front of your phone?
You can't. Like stagecraft is something you cannot learn on your phone. You just can't. It is like you need to die in front of a crowd. You need to have the best time. You need to go through all of those different things. Especially if you're a front man or front woman, you need to be able to, how do I read the audience? Yeah. All of that kind of stuff. You just can't get that on the phone. Now, in saying all that, like TikTok has certainly opened huge marketing capacities for acts and bands. And I think when it started, and I think social media started, it was so exciting for music. Mm-hmm. Now it's just got really stale because it's all about, they're certainly not going to promote your music unless you're paying for it now. So it's just turned into another marketing tool. It's not. And then there's acts that break, some acts break and some get huge followings. But I'd say if you pull the thread in that, there's definitely a label behind some of it.
Yeah.
Trying to make it look like it's a TikTok thing.
100%.
But ultimately, do I think it's been good for music? No.
Okay.
No.
I don't. Yeah. That's my old lad in my day. But it's true.
Yeah. There is a difference between working a crowd and
An example of what I mean. Let's say Hozier.
Yep.
Hozier didn't become Hozier overnight.
No.
He was developed. And he was developed from the age of 15. He was heard, I think his manager, Caroline, heard his son was singing, I think Jerds and Bray was where he went to school. Mm. And he was singing. And I remember hearing him when he was 15 or 16. Somebody sent me a demo. I was like, oh wow. My God, this guy, this you hear it, this is something very special.
Yeah.
Mm. I hope he's developed. I hope he's given time. I hope he finds his sound. Mm-hmm. And he was. And he was developed over 5 years. I think it was 4 or 5 years before Take Me to Church came out. And then that's what he wanted. He wanted to, because he came over to write with us when we were living in London. And we were the wrong people for him because we were like pop production team.
Yeah, okay.
He wanted to make a gospel-y kind of sound. And he found a sound. He was loud to develop. And even when he first started playing live, he was very shy. Now if you go see Hozier, he's a superstar.
He
didn't become a superstar overnight. So that's craft.
Yeah.
That takes time. And I think if you even other acts like Prince, like the big thing for brilliant artistry is development. It takes time to get comfortable on stage, to get comfortable with your sound.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure TikTok's giving people that time.
Well, even his new song, Hozier's newest song, what's it called again? I'll take my whiskey.
It's not
whiskey.
It's number one in America.
Yeah.
Too sweet.
Apparently his label didn't that shit. Like that won't do well. Someone put a snippet on TikTok and it blew.
That's brilliant for TikTok because it's a brilliant marketing.
That's why
it's
sometimes.
And labels love it because it's free marketing.
True. Yeah.
They're like, they don't have to pay these big marketing budgets to go and push stuff. So just it does work. There's elements to it for me, but I do think it's really important that, like, if you are you're a musician, two things matter: a body of work, an album. You got to make a record, and your stagecraft.
Yeah.
And maybe you can do that way, but I think it's, don't think that you can create a real career by just being in front. You gotta get out and do that groundwork, and it can be terrifying for people who might be anxious in front of a crowd.
Yeah.
It can be tough. I think that's something where TikTok allows for people to have an audience who might go, I don't want to play live.
Yeah.
Because I'd fall apart if I played live.
Yeah.
And that's fine too.
And would you have been really anxious when you started singing live? Is that like, were you scared at first or no?
No. I don't know. I've never had social anxiety because like when you're on stage, you have no time to think. Yeah. Give me time to think and I'll fall apart.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Yeah, you're just thinking what's next, what song.
When you're on stage, you're not thinking. And some people have social anxiety. Some people just have kind of good old fashioned general anxiety.
Yeah.
Like me, where I just, like I could be watching Netflix and, you know, eating a tube of Pringles and being like, the world's ending.
Yeah.
Like, that's me. Put me on stage, show them grand.
I kind of like that. I think if I'm watching a film, I don't like watching films because I just get anxious.
We're all turning into just existential messes. I think COVID did it. I think COVID has driven us all a bit mad.
I thought it was going to be like an apocalypse, COVID.
Yeah,
it was scary.
It was scary because we didn't really know what was going
to happen. And there definitely are still people
who still suffer from
100% who are still like nervous about it.
Well, I definitely think young children, like all they saw was threat for like 3 years, 2.5 years, whatever it was. And like I have like friends and they're washing their hands all the time. So you have all this kind of compulsion stuff.
Yeah.
It was. I don't think we've even began to process what happened.
Like, no.
And we were just told to get on with things.
Yeah. One day it was just over.
Just
like,
go.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Back to normal.
Yeah. And none of us have gone back to normal. No. I think it's actually collectively like kind of shifted something in everybody.
In everybody.
Yeah.
And it's mad. It's the only thing in the world that we'll all ever go through together.
I think they'll talk about it in history books.
We hope. I don't want to see that.
That'll be in history.
Another pandemic, but hopefully no like nuclear wars or anything like that.
Oh, don't.
Please.
I think the
election's coming up. You then went on to do a master's in mindfulness.
Yeah.
What made you decide to do that? Like what was the, and how long was it actually to do? Was it like 2 years?
I did 2 years master's and I've always, like for my own mental health journey, I've always found it really difficult to sit still.
Yeah.
I've Like I used to get out of a shower and I'd have to keep walking and I couldn't sleep. I was always felt like there was something just living in me. It sounds ridiculous, but that's what it felt like.
Yeah.
I had this energy and it was just a deep anxiety I had. And for many reasons, I lived in Israel when I was 13. We ended up in the middle of a war, essentially, where you're now seeing in southern Lebanon. We lived there. And there was a war at the time called the 9-Day War, like the 9-Day War, Operation Accountability, and we were in the middle of it. So that triggered all this kind of panic attacks and stuff as a teenager. So I've always had this thing that I couldn't sit with myself or sit still. Mm-hmm. And I started studying Buddhism, which, you know, people are always terrified of because, you know, they you know, especially Irish people, because we have a weird relationship with what we think is religion. Buddhism is not a religion. It's a way of thinking. It's an ideology. And then mindfulness is closely linked to that. So I started to meditate. And I remember I tell the story. I was so embarrassed that I was meditating. I was so embarrassed that anyone would find out that I was meditating. This was years ago. So I put on a little YouTube video and I went up to my bedroom and I put the headphones on. Like, my dad was down cooking dinner. And I was like, oh, what? So I'll get into this meditation shit, see what it's like. And then about 5 minutes in, I was like, oh my God, this is kind of nice. This is lovely. I was like, I'm starting to relax here. This is ridiculous. This is, why am I only following this now? And then I heard my dad coming upstairs like, oh fuck, he's going to come in. And he comes into my room. He knocks on the door and I scream at him. I'm like, I am meditating. And I'm pretty sure he thinks I said something else.
Oh yeah. I was literally just going to say to you, a lot of young men would be like embarrassed like to go upstairs and be doing something else. Well, you know what I mean?
It was less embarrassing for me. For him to think that's what I was doing.
Yeah, it was meditating.
So I just didn't tell him. And then the irony of all that is like a few years later, I'm doing my master's in mindfulness and I'm teaching it. And this idea, so people who go, I could never do it. You couldn't sit me still for 5 seconds.
Really?
I was that kind of uncomfortable with myself all the time. And what meditation, ultimately what mindfulness does, it teaches you to sit with all the good, the bad and the ugly. And we all have all of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What we tend to do with the ugly stuff is we try to avoid it or push it away or pretend it doesn't exist. Whereas with mindfulness, I was like, well, I'm going to sit with that. I'm going to that thought or that memory or that thing that freaks you out. And you're like, fuck, I can't believe I did that. And you just sit with it. And then you start to go, where do I feel it? My body, or I feel it in my chest. And then you start to realize you don't need to run from it. And it's that type of stuff that really made me fall in love with this idea of mindfulness. But I wanted to get deeper into it, learn it and understand all aspects of the psychology behind it. And then my master's and ultimately now in the middle of my PhD, which a big core part of it is how do we not just mindfulness, but how do we teach mental skills to young children so they don't feel so overwhelmed by the world. So that's kind of the background of it. But mindfulness there's so much to it. Some people find it boring. Some people find it life-saving. It's not for everybody.
Mm.
I'm not into this wellness stuff where I just start preaching inspirational quotes to people. I don't know what people are going through.
Yeah.
All I do know is that humans are, you know, there's a beautiful Leonard Cohen quote that he said, there's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in.
Mm-hmm.
That's my starting point. We're all we all got a bit cracked. And it's grand.
Yeah.
And the thing about that is, to me, is that I long since walked away from the idea of like, this is how you should live.
Mm.
I don't know. Yeah. What do I know?
Difference of works for
people. Yeah, and different people have different things and different reasons for feeling the way they feel.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think we've created a far more accepting, empathetic society that allows people kind of address that stuff in themselves. And I celebrate that massively.
Yeah, I love how open you are about mental health. I think especially in Ireland, there's not enough of it. I think still probably more now than there would have been. But like, I think there still is a stigma, especially around men's, I think.
Well, I think we're okay with stress and anxiety and resilience. Yeah. But actually, when you get into the weeds with the more serious, difficult stuff, I still think we're very stigmatizing. We fear it. We don't understand it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the area. I've always weirdly said that I find dark stuff far more interesting. I find people who've had difficulty really interesting to talk to.
Yeah, they're always real funny.
They know a lot about that, but they all... A lot of them don't care. I do find I've kind of an attraction to the darkness.
Yeah.
And not in a depressing way. I just find it really interesting.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah. You know, people doing cartwheels up the meadow and everything's great in life, great. Like, that's lovely, but the best conversations I've had are with people who are trying to work out things in their heads.
Yeah.
And they're very reflective. They think a lot and they can be deeply humorous and dark humor. I love dark humor.
I love dark humor. You would love our group chat.
Be careful with them. Like dark humor. When somebody says something, you're like, whoa.
No, all the trauma that we've got, any of us have gone through, all of some kind of
it's
quote.
It's the only way, I don't know, is it an Irish thing or what is it? But like dealing with any sort of trauma, come at it with dark humour, it will just lighten the mood so much
more. A little bit better.
Yeah. You, when somebody says, like, yeah, it is, it's a really good coping strategy for some people, you know, and I think it's, I like it in other people. Like, I have friends who are just, who just say things about their own stuff that makes it really accessible. And
yeah.
I had a friend who, like, he lost his mum. And I remember it, this is the type of way, we were at the wake and his mum and the priest was sitting in, you know, sitting in the kitchen being all pious and nice and talking to everybody. And he's had his cup of tea and my mate goes, watch this. I'm like, oh, what's he going to do? And he went up and he just stood beside the priest and just looked at me and went, that's mummy's cup. And the priest was like, I'm really sorry, and washed it and all this.
God.
And he just kept staring at the priest. And then he walked out and he was like, we were all like, and then he said to the priest, I'm only joking.
Yeah.
But it's just that darkness. And then he sang, I just died in your arms tonight at the funeral.
No, he didn't.
I love this.
Wait, and then he what?
I just died in your arms tonight.
He just sang it.
And it's like an old 80s power ballad and he got up and sang it at the funeral. It's just, it's gold.
I love that.
But I think it's some people's coping mechanism, isn't it?
Yeah.
It just makes it light.
I think it's the best way.
That's not light.
And I think it's perfectly okay to do that.
Yeah.
About your own situation.
Yeah, unless you're not offending anybody or hurting anybody.
No.
Saying like it's just a way of coping.
Yeah.
The world can be a very overwhelming place and sometimes if you bring a bit of dark humour to it, there's no harm.
Lighten it a little bit.
Did you ever try the medicinal route of like anxiety, like medication and things like that?
For many years,
How did you find it?
For nearly... I never believed I had a broken brain. I never believed there was something... There was something that had happened to me that I never coped with.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to kind of get to the bottom of that. And I was on medication for nearly 12 years.
Okay.
And it certainly helped me at a time I needed. Like I was certainly all over the shop at one stage. Even when I was doing The Voice, I was taking beta blockers and Valium. Like I was just to get on TV at certain points because I was terrified I'd have a panic attack on television. That was my biggest fear.
Mm.
So I was having so many of them. But I think ultimately what I needed to do was to try and figure out why I was feeling like that. And that's what happened. I ended up going through treatment with some amazing psychologists who kind of over time kind of got it out of me and allowed me realize that, you know, the way I was probably dealing with things was probably quite normal.
Yeah, for
and
what happened.
That was the stuff. I think sometimes a good psychologist to make you feel less like you're losing your mind is definitely quite comforting. And that's what I had. So, I mean, there's many theories. It's a big focus of my PhD research is the interventions we use for people.
Mm-hmm.
Like what should we be using?
Yeah.
And once again, there's a huge subjective element to that. Like, it's very hard to know unless you're sitting in front of the person.
Yeah.
But I think the most important thing that should be asked if somebody walks into a room in distress is not what's wrong with you, it's what happened to you. I think it's really important.
Oh, wow.
And it's often we don't do that.
Yeah.
We don't.
So not necessarily that something is wrong with you.
Something might be very much right with you. If you're like in my case, like having panic attacks after experiencing like a war, that's quite a healthy response. If there's people listening to this who are anxious after COVID, I would argue that's a pretty good, a fair human response to what we all went through.
Mm-hmm.
Would you be saying there's something wrong with us? But the problem is it's really uncomfortable. No one likes it. We don't enjoy feeling this way. We all want to be high-fiving and fist-pumping the world and thinking everything's great.
Yeah.
But some of us didn't cope with COVID.
Yeah.
And some of, especially young children, are anxious. And rather than going, just what's wrong with you? I'm like, well, you just went through a global pandemic. That'll do it.
That's enough.
That'll do it.
That will definitely do it.
What do you think is the line between someone like feeling anxious and then like having like anxiety? Like when is the line of someone being like, right, this actually is not just feeling anxious about something coming up? Or like...
I think there's a dysfunction to it. And I think like I always revert to like Dr. Tony Bates, who was my mentor, and my partner Louise, a psychologist. Like I would ask, so my PhD is research in sociology. So I'm really interested in culture and society, whereas they'd be interested in the individual. And dysfunctional anxiety, like I can only speak in my own case. It affects your relationships. It affects your sleep. It affects your diet, your food. It's the thing that cloaks over everything. And it can feel very, what happens when I used to get anxious, my world would become very small and I couldn't see anything. I couldn't experience anything. It was just, everything got very small and suffocating. And as I said, I couldn't be in it. I left my jobs. It's dysfunction. It's probably the best way to describe it. And then you convince yourself that it's not dysfunctional. until it comes to a point where it becomes very clear to others it's become dysfunctional. And in some ways that could be addiction. You might fall into addiction to try and deal with it because you can't cope with the kind of overwhelm that you experience. And once again, that's my experience of it.
Yeah.
Then what happens with general anxiety that we all experience, like that nerve before something we don't like doing, you need to feed into that. That's a life-saving experience. But human beings are literally anxiety on eggs. That's all we are. That's how we're built. But much of our world is anxiety provoking. And online, you go online for 5 seconds, it's anxiety provoking. It's where we spend most of our lives. So yeah, I think dysfunctional anxiety from my position and my own case was it affected every part of my life.
Every
single part of my life. I could not see anything other than what I was experiencing. And then the breakthrough of that was, as I said, I started getting proper help, proper professional help.
Yeah.
The other thing is that professional help wasn't a click of a finger. And it certainly wasn't a linear experience. I went through a lot to get through it. And I still go through it. I still experience different things that would happen. And I still get help. I still work with people.
Yeah.
My work can be overwhelming in itself. So I just have literally no fear of speaking about it in any way. But I do think everyone's experience is very subjective to them.
Yeah. I think that really helps people as well, hearing someone else talk about it so openly.
Yeah.
Because I think it should be. It's like breaking your arm, or like if you go to the doctor about anything, like your head should be treated the same.
The same way.
I wish you could get your brain scanned though, like, and see. Like, I wish you could actually see things.
You see, you can scan your brain and it'll tell you how your brain functions.
Yeah, but not your
mind. It's the mind.
Yeah, like, your mind.
I don't know how, so when I'm looking in my research at 200 years of intervention for mental health, when I look at the human mind, I don't know how much further on we were than we were 200 years ago to really understanding what goes on up there. And, you know, I think good psychologists and psychotherapists kind of are very good at kind of uncovering stuff and stuff like that. But I definitely think part of me is that culture and society. I always say it's not most of the time, it's not the individual that has to change. It's their environment.
Yeah.
Like, you know, somebody who is overwhelmed by their, like when I was in school, like in the 80s and 90s, there was children with autism that were just so badly treated. We didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
Some teachers were brutal to them.
Yeah.
And that's changed. But now what we have now is we understand this, but we don't have schools and systems that are actively properly supporting people overwhelmed by their worlds. Or imagine Adam Harris, I don't know if you, Simon's brother, he's one of the top autism activists in the country. He's a charity called As I Am. Yeah. He has autism. I said, explain to me what it can feel like sometimes. Because I think when we can relate to what it must feel like, it makes it easier to understand. And he said, imagine I just picked you up right now and he dropped you into the middle of Tokyo in the middle of the night, you know, where you knew nobody, what was going on. He said, that's what it feels like sometimes just to leave the house. And what he meant is it's just the world overwhelms him sometimes.
Yeah.
So I can, I've never been in Tokyo, but I don't want to be dropped into Tokyo. It's a sensory overload. And that was a great way of explaining it to me. So now I can almost tap into what that must feel like just to do normal stuff.
Yeah.
So that's the stuff I start to learn. Another friend of mine has a daughter who was so, so anxious. She's an unbelievable girl, and she's really bright, and she wouldn't leave the house, and she was studying for Leaving Cert, and he was getting really upset with her, and he wasn't getting angry with her, but he was frustrated with her because he couldn't understand what was wrong. So I said to him, right, how do I get through to this lad? I said, one thing I know about this guy is he hates flying. He'll never get in an airplane, hates flying. And I said to him, right, tomorrow morning, you have to go up to Dublin Airport and get in a flight. What would you do? He goes, I'd be gone. Forget about it. You wouldn't get me. Not five of you wouldn't drag me onto that thing. I'm like, okay, cool. How do you feel? He goes, I feel like I'm going to get sick. I said, well, that's what it's like for your daughter to leave the house.
Yeah.
And now he understands the feeling.
Okay.
Doesn't understand why she feels that way. In the same way that your fear is as irrational as hers, now you know what she feels. Now he looks at her and goes, she is unbelievable. Look at the strength of her. She's getting an airplane every day in his head.
Yeah.
What happened then?
It's a different way of kind of looking at it.
It is. Their relationship got stronger. Yeah. What happens when the relationship gets stronger and he understood? She starts to get stronger. And this is the thing. And this is, you find a way to meet people where they're at with this stuff.
Mm,
and rather than going, well, why would you feel that way? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You don't know.
Yeah.
Aww.
So that, I think that helped.
Yeah. 100%. You have started a podcast series about St. Lomans. Can you tell us?
I'm very intrigued in this now.
Yeah.
Well,
very.
Part of me is kind of going, why would you want to do a podcast series on a psychiatric institution, an asylum? Like, I'm a glutton.
No, like, love all this.
Yeah. Our history with this stuff is really important.
Yeah.
It's really, really important. And there's a lot of answers there. I grew up in Mullingar and there's a psychiatric hospital there called St. Norman's, and it's massive. It's a massive, massive building. It's always terrified me. And everybody I know, lots of my friends' family would have worked there. And, you know, it's just huge. And in a town like Mullingar, you know, at that time, it would have just been the biggest building there. Like, the cathedral and the barracks. But growing up, I was terrified to tell people what was going on for me because I was terrified that's where they put me. Because that was the threat we always had in Ireland.
You're going up to Lomans.
I'm like, in my head, it's like...
And that's terrifying.
That's where I could end up going. So, but for me, I looked at the history. So I looked at... There's a graveyard in St. Lomans and it's a mass grave. So this is a field. There's 1,304 people buried in that field. And the serious is about telling the story of one of them. And one of these women who went in there because she accused her husband of cheating on her. Her husband cheated on her and basically said she threw tea at him and ended up getting committed there and dying 20 years later. And it turns out he was cheating on her because he put the children into a workhouse 2 days after she was put in there. But in Irish law, the person who puts you in has to take you out. So this is what happened with a lot of women. A lot of men. Without evidence, they would say they're delusional or they're this, that and the other, and they'd be put into asylums and they'd died there. A lot of men ended up in asylums for different reasons. Usually violence and alcoholism was a big one. But this is a part of our history that we haven't even began to address. So there's this woman buried in that grave and we were telling her story and we're telling the story of how she was failed. But more importantly, these places that terrify us, that you can say you're intrigued in, the best way to reduce that fear is to humanize them. And the best way to humanize them is to tell the story of people who were in there.
Yeah.
And one line she said in the documentary from her medical records, the opening line was, "I'm not crazy and neither are half the people in here." And they really weren't. Most of them, there was very little wrong with them. And the problem is Ireland was an immensely poor country. We had famines, we had civil wars, we had war for independence, we had colonialism, we had all that stuff. And what we had is a very traumatized nation of people.
Mm.
And what did we do with them? We put them into institutions because we didn't know what to do with them. And I wanted to tell that story to humanize it, but more importantly, to rebuild that grave, that cemetery, and put their names and crosses and actually build a cemetery to those 1,304 people. And to build a memorial wall for them and to make that the symbol of this is the, like, young people are so proactive now around destigmatizing mental health.
Mm.
We cannot destigmatize mental health until we understand where the stigma came from.
Okay.
And the stigma came from places like this.
Yeah.
Every film you watch in horror movies is going to have that trope of the guy who breaks out of a psychiatric institution and goes murders loads of people.
Mm.
That's the conditioning we're being hit with. That's where your stigmas come from. Yeah. So I wanted to get this series and I wanted to tell those stories so people who might fear places like that will go, oh my God, these are like my mom, like my sister or my brother. And they really were. And in 1950, Ireland had the highest level of people in psychiatric hospitals in the world.
Really?
Jesus. We loved putting people in there.
That's not even that long ago.
How many institutions like that do we have in Ireland?
22.
Or did we have, sorry?
They call them the District Lunatic Asylums. That's what they were called.
That's what they called them?
That's what you used to call them.
The name of them though, like lunatic.
And it sounds offensive. And then you see now with people, we still use words like lunatics.
Yeah.
Like,
I didn't know lunatic was an official word.
It was. So that's what we used to call people, who were put into institutions, was the District Lunatic Asylum. That's why the series is called the Madman's Hotel, which might sound a little bit offensive to us now, but that was the contextual language of the day. That's how we spoke about people. And it's important that we keep that stuff, even if it might offend people, because I'm not overly concerned about offending people. I'm more concerned about telling accurate stories and using the difficult part of our history. And the thing about it is, there's beautiful stories there as well. There's stories of the nurses that used to care for them.
Yeah.
Because a lot of their families didn't want them. So you know what the saddest part of the whole story? Julie went in there for 20 years. She didn't have one visitor.
Not one.
Not one. She sat at that window every day waiting for someone to come see her. And nobody came. And she died of a broken heart in 1919. Yeah. And she is grave 339. And they used to bury them with numbers, not even a name, like they were prisoners.
That shows a little respect they had. Like, it's just when being.
And there's your stigma. So what I'm trying to do is, if people keep talking about reducing stigmas and mental health, I'm like, if you want to do it, let's learn where they come from.
Yeah.
And even if it's difficult stuff, let's actually look at. And it's really interesting as well. And it's Ireland's history of how we treated women, especially, is unless we actually address it, it will darken our society forever. And you look at the Magna Nonnery, mother and baby homes, and the asylums, and these are stories that now have to be told. And I always say to families who think they had people in there, I always say, your loved one did not fail society. Society failed them.
Yeah.
I think that's why we wrote the series.
Wow. And is that still a law now that you have to be the same person that puts you in can, has to
no.
be out?
Oh, no. The legal act, no. That was called the Dangerous Lunatics Act. That's what it was called. Like.
Jesus.
So there's all these legal acts. There's still a lot of grey area in mental health mm-hmm. at that level, mm-hmm. Legality stuff that we got to work out. And that's the work that we do. And the thing about it is, right, I get this. People listening to this go, oh my God, that's heavy. This isn't. What's heavy for me is if we ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
What's depressing is if we ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
I think, yes, some people might go, I find that difficult. It is difficult, but mm-hmm. I think it's the right thing to do
yeah.
to talk about it. And there's some beautiful stories and there's some beautiful people. And I've read those stories. There's, you know, without getting into the detail of them, it's not as dark as you might think.
Okay.
It just feels like we didn't know what to do with different. So we buried it.
Yeah.
Or we put people in institutions. And there are people who are poets. There was a lovely story of this woman, Hannah Greeley, in St. Omans in Mullingar. She was a poet. She used to write poetry on the canal, writing beautiful poetry. And people was like, who's she? And they put her into an institution after she was a nurse. And during World War II, her hospital was bombed. And she was traumatized by it.
Yeah,
and she was
put
in there.
Yeah.
And she was in there for 15 years.
And in there, would they be getting any kind of care? Is it just a place to put them and to say...
Like they used to care for them.
Away and yeah.
They used to care. I think when it started, it was mm-hmm. a place of refuge. And then they just become so overcrowded that they couldn't do anything. They just had to numb them. And then some of the treatments were really difficult, like the lobotomy. And then insulin coma therapy. They used to give people malaria. So they'd have seizures from a fever, thinking that would be the thing that kicks out the madness. So this stuff is what happened. And I think it's really interesting. Once again, that there's so many elements of this that still kind of prevail in our current mental health system. And people always keep saying, why is our mental health system so dysfunctional? Because I think we haven't even began to address this stuff.
Yeah. All that stuff.
And I think we have to do it. And don't get me wrong, I don't want to be doing this all my life. It's not, it's tough stuff.
I can imagine.
But it's also, it's storytelling.
Yeah.
And what we are doing with the Badlands Hotel is telling a story. And when you tell a story, it makes it easier for people to listen
mm-hmm.
rather than going, all these bad things happened, this place was terrible.
Just saying all the bad
things.
All the facts.
Yeah.
And I'm quite hopeful about what this hopefully will do. That mm-hmm. will. I think I'd love to see a state apology. I'd like to see whoever's our next Taoiseach apologize to the families and not for any form of kind of blaming anybody, but just it's the right thing to do. I think it would go a long way to make a lot of these families feel a little bit less stigmatized.
Yeah.
And I think Ireland could be the real symbol to do it. And I think no other country has ever done that.
Yeah.
Why not us?
Yeah.
Did you go down to Lomans in Mullingar? Inside? Yeah.
I wasn't inside for this, but I have been inside St. Lomans.
You?
Yeah. And the really strange thing was, like, we were trying to get access to the medical records, but understandably we couldn't. But we were almost easier to find medical records by going on TikTok and watching the lads who were breaking into St. Lomans.
Okay.
There was like loads
People
of TikToks of lads breaking into St. Lomans. And
they were finding medical records?
And they were filming medical records. I think, to be fair to the HSE, they got an awful shock when that happened. And now they've moved to archive all those records to protect them. Yeah.
Okay.
And so some of those records will be Julia's records.
Yeah.
So Julia, who was in there, mm-hmm. who we told the story of, mm-hmm. we have 7 pages of her medical records, but there's 100 pages missing.
Wow.
So families have a right to those.
How would you go about getting all the medical records then? Does it have to be family that gets them?
Yeah.
Like, is
That's
it
HSE?
Okay.
So you'd fill out a freedom of information and you'd ask the HSE for them and they might give them to you, they mightn't.
They might not, yeah.
That's the problem. There's no actual, it's too vague.
Yeah.
And they might give you the records, but some pages are missing or they'd redact, they'd take out certain words or they'd blacken certain words. So we got to have a template for what mm-hmm. we do. Some families won't want them. And even recently we saw around adoption records, like, because of our history of institutionalization, we got to get much more kind of definitive of how families are allowed access to these records, because it really does help them
mm-hmm.
make sense of what happened. So they're trying to piece together Julia's life.
Yeah.
Did anyone visit her? Did she, you know, did she get out at any stage? Was she perfectly fine? They don't know because they only have 7 pages of her records. So these are the things that we want to know.
Yeah.
And I think families have a right to.
And it probably affects generations as well, like generational trauma going on, not knowing what happened to your granny or great, like whoever it is.
So it was a really beautiful story, and without giving away too much of the show, there was a farmer from Westmead, big big farmer and a lovely warm character, and we were putting the crosses back in.
Mm-hmm.
He was holding the cross of his great-grandmother, and he was holding it across his chest. And I said to him, I said, do you mind me asking why this is so raw for you? Like she died 90 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
He says, because that woman affected my grandmother and affected my mother and it affected me.
Yeah.
Because that shame of her was passed on and passed on and passed on.
Yeah.
So I'm not putting this in the ground for just my great-grandmother. I'm putting it in the ground for my family. And it's just that stuff, I think, that's stuff I didn't think about
when
I was doing it.
Yeah.
So yeah, and it's a good story. And I think what I'd love to see happen in St. Olmans is, there's a place called Grange Gorman, which is up the road, was the biggest asylum in Ireland. It's now one of the most impressive universities I have ever seen.
Wow.
Unbelievable campus. They've turned it into this world-class educational. Yeah, it's just up
there.
In Phibsborough.
Yeah. Well, I dropped out, but I went. I did go there.
Well, that used to be Grange Gorman. That used to be the biggest asylum in the country.
Was it?
And they've done this unbelievable job. And I'm looking at St. Olmans and go, let's do that to St. Olmans. Let's turn it into a place where we can educate nurses, doctors, psychiatrists, psychologists.
Is it just derelict now? Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's asbestos and all sorts of shit. We're not allowed to touch the front. Like, as scary as it is, it's a very impressive building.
It's fairly
slick. Like, I wouldn't go into it now if you paid.
Would you still be how you felt when you were younger?
No, because now I know the stories. I've humanized it. I wouldn't sleep in there now, but I've humanized it.
Overnight away?
No, I wouldn't be. The actual, there's a hotel in Sligo that used to be, I think, St. Columb's or something like that, and now is the Clayton Hotel in Sligo. That was one of the biggest asylums in the Northwest. I think Paul Mescal told a story about waking up in the middle of the night there and something moving in his room.
Oh, but,
I don't know if Paul Mescal was, maybe he was on the beer or something.
Yeah, who knows?
I don't know.
Who knows?
And those 1,304 graves, like, why did they do that instead of bring them to an actual graveyard?
Because for many reasons, it's a really good question. A lot of the families, there was nowhere to bury them because the families didn't want to deal with it. I don't want to deal with it. I don't want to know that my loved one was in St. Olmans, so just bury them in the hospital. Some families did take their loved ones out and bury them in cemeteries, in the family plots. But some of the other stuff that was pretty grim was we've records of patients having to dig the graves for the other patients. So that type of stuff was pretty depressing.
Knowing that's
heavy,
where they might end up. And, yeah, you know, and that's the thing. Like, they did a dig. The archaeologist John Tierney did an amazing dig of the place, and he kind of told us, like, some kids over there. You know, it was so. All we want to do is, when you walk in there now, there's 12 crosses of families that have come forward that said we want to put loved ones' crosses back in with their names on it. So we got the crosses for them. We put their names on it. What I would love to see is that field full of them.
Yeah,
and the families coming forward and going, I want to do that for my loved one, and I want to bring my grandchild there and say, this is where your great-grand... And educate people in this stuff. And I'd love to see it turn into a beautiful garden and make it symbolic. Like, can't pretend this didn't happen.
Yeah.
But we can use it as a symbol for where we want to go and what we want to do, and acknowledge that that a lot of these people were failed. Let's not get into the blame game side of it. Let's do the right thing.
Yeah.
And that's kind of ultimately a big memorial wall. And my dream is that there's a memorial wall there with everybody's name on it.
Yeah.
Now, we're probably going to need consent for everybody's name on it.
Yeah.
And we mightn't get everybody's name on it. And we might only get 100, but that's 100 more than we would have had.
Than you would have. How hard do you think it's going to be to find everyone?
I just hope families come forward.
Yeah. Is that what it's going to take?
Yeah. I mean, we have the records. Like, we, you know, but the right thing would be that the families come forward and say, "I, there's no shame here.
Yeah.
I would love my loved one's name to be on that wall." I'd love to see that. And I think we'd have to work very closely with the HSE here. It's easy for us to say this. The HSE are a massive organization. And, you know, we often hear the difficult stories of the HSE, but they've been pretty good, I'll be honest. And this is a sensitive, difficult area for them.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely not on the top of their priority list.
No, yeah.
But they've been pretty good. Like, and I interviewed the CEO, Bernard Gloucester, on the series, and he apologized.
Did he?
And then the other thing he did that I thought was really quite incredible. I asked him, what are we going to do? And he goes, I don't know.
Okay.
You know, when someone says that to you,
don't
throw it back in their face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
People go, well, he's the CEO. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
He actually, if somebody has the humility to say, I don't know the answer.
Yeah.
then we got to go, right, let's have a think about what we think we can do.
Okay.
Let's do it together. Let's figure out what that might be. Wow. I think that to me was quite a humbling thing to hear somebody with that hype. Because you tell a politician, they'll always come up with some answer.
Some answer that never happens.
And,
yeah.
And you'd be like...
What you want to hear.
Yeah, yeah. And he goes, get me out of this interview. That's probably what you're thinking. Whereas he went, I don't know.
Yeah.
And I've never thrown that back in someone's face. So yeah. Hopefully we can do something with that.
Yeah. What initially grabbed your attention to do the series? Like, you obviously always knew what St. Lomans was, but like, what made you think of her? I want to like deep dive into it.
What happened to me was, it's just a mad story. I got a petition sent to me, an uplift petition from a friend of mine. It said, restore 1,304 graves in St. Lomans. And I was like, no, thank you. I'm not dealing with that. Yeah. I was all over the shop at that point. I was like, what I don't need in my life is to start looking at cemeteries and asylums.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then it just kept coming back. Really? And four years later, it was mad. The joke is that the Blizzards are supporting the Black Eyed Peas in Galway. Mad story. And the girl, Julie, who's Julia's great-granddaughter, was in Galway. She was the one who started the petition. And I just got this text going, I see her in Galway. And I rang her. And the minute I talked to her, I went, I'm in.
Really?
I'm in this story.
That's all it took.
I can't. I was like sitting there and I was on the phone to her. And Will I Am walks past, who I'm not the world's biggest Black Eyed Peas fan, but I wanted to meet Will I Am.
Yeah, of course.
And he walked past and I was going, do I hang up in this? I went, no, I won't. So I chose Julie Clark over Will I Am, and it was the best decision I've ever made. So yeah, and I ultimately met him then after. Asked him, do you want to go Supermax? But he had no interest.
Did he go?
No. He did.
He was lovely though. We were the worst. Like, I don't know why we were supporting them. We were like kind of quite a loud guitar band.
Yeah.
And then it was Gabrielle, who was amazing, and Black Eyed Peas. And then we were on, and people were like, so these young Black Eyed Peas fans going, who are these
lads? Who are these?
But I mean, still going to do it. Got to meet Black Eyed Peas. Yeah. Minus Fergie.
Oh, she's not there.
No, she wasn't in it. She was gone. Which was kind of, I would have thought she was the Black Eyed Peas. Will I Am and her was like, but she was gone, I think, about 2 years at that stage. They were still brilliant.
Who was the most famous person you've like supported or even met?
We supported Oasis in Stain Castle. Yeah, that was definitely.
Did you meet?
Lovely.
Really?
Yeah, lovely. And Noel Gallagher wouldn't get a photograph of me. And I was like, raging. And he goes, you're just too tall. And I was like,
is he really small?
He's quite, but he was joking. And then he kind of got up in a little step and took
the
photograph.
He has to stand on a step.
But nobody, he was kind of just, because I was like, I was in a pair of wellies, so I had heels on.
Yeah.
And got a photograph of him. And then Liam came in like 2 hours later, and they're obviously, they were in different dressing rooms anyway. But then ACDC, we supported ACDC the week after that.
Wow.
In Punchestown. So they were our two big kind of, what are we doing here? And I remember Deckard, the drummer, who I grew up with, we were walking on stage at ACDC. He used to play ACDC on the drums, like air drums behind me in French class. And I remember just thinking, this is just ridiculous. This is mad. Like, how are we?
You just have to kind of stop yourself and be like,
how are we here? This is ridiculous. And we were the wrong band to be supporting ACDC. Like, we're not a heavy rock band.
No, yeah.
So there was like 70,000 metalers in Punchestown going, who are these lads? And the first thing I said is like, what would you guys do? Like, if someone said, do you want to support ACDC? I'm like, I'm not going to say no.
Yeah.
So I know they were actually lovely. We ended up playing Beat It by Michael Jackson. He had died a couple of days before that.
Wow.
And all the metalers like singing Michael Jackson, which was some experience. But yeah, I've been very lucky with that stuff. That's where you learn a lot about yourself walking on stage in front of 60,000 metalers.
Do you ever meet anyone that's real rude? Any celebs?
You see, I always wary of saying this because...
No, I
am. Not because... I don't mind saying who, but it's some people are just having a brutal day.
True.
Yeah, and could be a bad day.
I hate that stuff on TikTok when they go, I met this person and they were... I mean, if it's the same person...
Sometimes it's over and over.
Yeah, and then that's fair enough. Yeah, maybe there may be a bit of a kind of a... But maybe that's what the algorithm's doing. But like, I've never met an absolute... What I would suggest is usually the really, really famous people, the big people, and I've met loads of them, they're actually always the soundest.
I've heard that before.
Ones trying to hustle up the game a little bit.
Yeah, kind
of their ego might be a little bit too...
There was one, I won't tell you what it was, but we were doing a gig, it was on The Voice, and it wasn't the band, it was their tour manager.
Okay.
And it was their big band, and they were performing on it. And he came in, and he was so horribly rude to our stage manager, who I... loved. She was the coolest, best woman. She kept me going the whole time. And she came in and she's a really stoic, strong woman. And she came into my dressing room and she was just white. She goes, She was shaking. She goes, I've never been spoken to like that before in my life. I said, sit down there a second. I said, I went out to him.
Did you?
Oh, I went out and I just said to him, and I knew when as I was walking up to him,
yeah,
something's gone wrong for this lad today. Something right. bad has happened to him. And so rather than get angry with him, I says, do you think the way you spoke to her was warranted? And he went, what, it's the game we're in. I'm like, no, it's not the game we're in, dude. You can't speak to people like that. And then I was ready to blow, because it was what he said to her was brutal. No, nice. And he just put his hand over his head. He goes, I'm having a really rough day. And I said, that's fine. I said, mm-hmm. and we all lose our cool. Like, and I said, you can't speak like that. It doesn't look good for the man.
No.
And then he was shaking. I was like, oh my God. So easily I could have been like, but I brought him into the dressing room and he just made this quite a very sincere apology.
Okay.
And see, the reason I'm saying this story is like, we could have just went, he's horrible.
Yep.
And he's horrible and the band are horrible and they're all too big for the boots, all kinds of stuff. But if you give it a bit of time, there's generally a reason someone's acting like that. But I think in the UK, what I have found is you definitely have more. Celebrity is much more a thing in the UK, where they think there's a level of entitlement, and I don't think anyone has entitlement.
No.
I don't think anybody has it. I don't think it exists as much in Ireland at all. But I don't think it's in the UK. It's often the managements and the agents that make them out that way. So like you're this person,
and that's big just, them up to kind of be like,
but that's just agents trying to make their commission.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're telling them, you know, this like. And sometimes they'd come over and I'd say to them when they're coming on The Voice, I'm like, lads, this doesn't work like that here.
No.
You can't be acting
Bring them
like
back
that.
Down a peg.
Yeah. Don't be. And actually, like we were very lucky in The Voice. We had a couple of, like we had Dolores O'Riordan. Like Dolores and me were very close. And Dolores was she was one of the most iconic female singers of all time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Would you think it?
No.
Yeah. No, she did. She just had the crack and she used to... We go for walks before shows together and just walk around and chat. And that's what I mean. One of the greatest female singers of all time.
I think Irish people, it's just, we've said it before, we're like, you actually couldn't be like,
you wouldn't be allowed.
Big fear of it.
Yeah, you wouldn't be allowed.
No.
We had Niall Horan on the podcast before and we were like, well, he's like, not, and he was lovely.
And he's
like,
a Mullingar. Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
But like anyone I've ever met that's Irish is always just
you
like,
just can't have
his
that.
You have the mutual.
Niall's greatest achievement, and I know obviously he's sold millions of records and he said that, is that, for what I can tell, he's still the same guy.
Yeah, he's still
100%.
That's
from
his
what
greatest
we,
achievement.
Still Niall from Mullingar.
And you can't be like, that's that world they're in is, it's, unless you're in it, it's impossible to understand. I can't understand it. You just couldn't.
No.
And I think that's his greatest achievement. I think hopefully that's something, you know, that he understands in himself. And I look at his group of friends, they're all the same.
Yeah.
Same lads, like.
Yeah.
So, I know. It's not an easy world, I'd say they're in.
No.
You couldn't give me all the money in the world to do it.
Could you not?
No. Me neither.
No.
Have that level of fame
is scary. I don't think it's healthy for anyone to have that level of fame.
No,
I feel like it's like everything you do is under a microscope. Like you have constant people watching you and going wherever you are. Like that's,
you're held to a standard then as well.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
every move you make is scrutinized.
He was like
so young.
Obviously, what happened with Liam is just heartbreaking. These guys were so young and you know, it's nothing prepares you for it. There's nothing you can do to prepare for it.
Yeah, no. And there's no manual on it.
No. And everyone has different personality types. Certain people deal with things better and other people can't. So it's a difficult one. And I think I always say, like, if I had children, would I let them into the music industry? That side of the music industry, I'd rather them play rugby. And that's saying something.
That's saying something. Yeah. He says rugby over that.
Yeah. I just don't know. I don't think it's regulated enough. Yeah, I don't think there's enough true understanding at the label level of human psychology and insecurity and all the stuff that comes with that. And I think you throw into the mix social media and now you're in the Wild West.
And different ball game.
I think if labels continue to do that, there has to be far stronger mechanisms in place.
To protect.
And then the thing is that we start saying, oh, you know, well, there are loads of money. That argument has to... doesn't matter, like.
Yeah, it doesn't outweigh it.
Frailties, like if you're going through stuff, you're going through stuff and you don't know what to do, you don't have the right people around you. It's terrifying.
Yeah.
And I think Niall has done, like, and also, like, what I really respect about Niall is, I remember him talking to me years ago about, like, bands like the Eagles, right? And that's the music I want to make. I want to make that, and that's what he did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He stuck, he's making the music he loves.
Stuck to what you said.
The music he listens to.
Yeah.
I've seen him supporting Lloyd Daniels in the Academy before he went on X Factor, and I was in the queue to meet Lloyd Daniels with my mom, And he was down on the stage and he was selling CDs. I was like, "Mom, please, can I go in?" She was like, "No, we're in the queue now. We're not going." And I was right. And I seen him.
I remember when the X Factor just kicked out. I was living in London at the time, and I kind of, this young lad from Mullingar only up the road, and he arrived at my house one day, but they were about to go on a tour for What Makes You Beautiful. And I'd heard the song. I'm like, "Oh my God, they're going to be huge." Because I just knew it was a hit. It was a pure pop hit. I just knew this was going to explode. They were already exploding. I said, "This is the thing." And he came right with this guitar with like three strings in it. He goes, will you fix my guitar up? He goes, "Because I'm going to be playing the guitar on the radio tour." Like, because we're off to do the radio tour. So we were sitting there like tuning this piece of shit guitar. Like, but you're not... buy yourself a decent guitar here, like, and but they hadn't kicked off at that stage.
No.
And off, then I was watching on BBC One the next day with this guitar playing What Makes You Beautiful. Yeah, and
wow,
I remember before I said, I remember hearing it going, "Whoa,
yeah,
you just know,
yeah,
yeah, you just know, but, yeah." And that's it, that was it, the Into Orbit.
Where can people listen to the series?
Yeah,
it's only on Audible, so Audible. Okay. A lot of people have like Audible is. It's where I listen to, like, you've just so much books and amazing documentaries on it. It's just an incredible platform. I've always loved it. So it's a real, I'm just chuffed to be on it.
Yeah.
With this. So yeah.
I'm going to get a drive home now.
Yeah, listen. And I think it's you know, it's quite an emotional thing to listen to. It's not that, some people go, "I got angry, I got sad, I got emotional, I got happy."
A bit of everything.
The whole thing. Yeah. You'll go through it all. But ultimately, what I think it is, it's us recognizing what happened. And I do this work for one reason only. I think we can be world leaders at what we should do for mental health. I think Ireland, Irish people believe in fairness above everything else.
Yes.
I think it's a huge part of our psyches. And I think we're a tiny little country, 5 million people. Like, we're the size of like greater Manchester. We're wealthy. We're relatively politically stable. Mm-hmm. Most of us are pretty sound. we're internationally. Why can't we be the people that set the bar? Yeah. Why can't we show the world what to do?
So true.
Let's be the case study for how we better take care of people who find themselves overwhelmed by the world.
Yeah.
And anyone listens, we could all be there.
Yeah.
You know?
And I think things like grief, relationship issues, stress, stuff we all deal with. And sometimes we can't quite cope with it. And I think it's important to understand, like, I'm glad that we no longer put people in places like that who can't cope. So that to me is the hopeful element of it, I suppose.
Yeah. Amazing. No, thank you so much for coming
on. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Amazing. Thank you.
Cheers, guys.
So that was it for this week's episode of the podcast. I have to tell the story because I told Niall off camera. But my mom, our moms,
love
him. And I was doing a orchestra concert in the concert hall. I think it was it in school? Secondary school.
You're playing the violin?
I'm playing the violin, yeah. Or else I was singing. I've done two in the concert hall. My mom came and she was in the bathroom and she overheard people talking. And she thought they said that Brezzy was coming and she was absolutely buzzing. And then turns out it was the president. She misheard it. Like, Brezzy. Like, she got it wrong. But yeah, I know she's buzzing to come on the podcast.
She was fuming. Said, it was just the president.
She's like, "For fuck's sake, just Michael D."
No, that was a really interesting chat.
Really, really
enjoyed that. And I genuinely am going to go on, download that listen to it.
It is so important to know about
highlight these things
in our past, because it is generational trauma. Like, you know that you store trauma that if your nanny went through it, it's actually in you.
Like in my genes? Like,
women carry three generations of trauma in them.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. So little things, it's like the more you know, and it does really, like, when we think of, like, I first heard of St. Lomans, you think of it as a building and a thing, but like Niall said, when you humanize someone,
yeah,
it makes it all feel more real.
You don't just look at the building itself and the concrete and the bad things that happen. The
number of people, the actual people itself. Yeah.
Mad.
So interesting and so important for us. But you can go back to listen to our bonus episode as well if you want to after this. For Monday, we have some dilemmas and things in there. It's Home I Drink Extra Juice. And don't forget, you watch us now on YouTube too.
Hello!
Every Thursday at 12. And we have some YouTube videos too.
Yes.
We'll see you then.
That is.
Also, if you haven't bought your tickets yet for the live shows, head to UCH Box Office for tickets for November 23rd in Limerick. And we will see you there.
We'll see you in Limerick, bird.
Like, rate and subscribe.
Thanks.
Love you.
Love you.
Bye.
Subscribe to this podcast for free on the Go Loud app.